Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Jackie Witt. I'm a professor here at the Army War College and the War Room podcast editor. I'm here today with Dr. Andrew Hill, who is our editor of the War Room, and Dr. Paul Kahn, who is also a professor.
Thank you, Jackie, for having us here.
Definitely.
All right, so what we're going to try to do today is talk about a concept, and we're going to see sort of where it goes. We haven't pre-planned questions. We haven't pre-planned a script. But what I'd like to throw out is a term that actually originated with the Army War College, maybe a couple decades ago. And it's a term that I have some...
You hate. Okay. This is Andrew, by the way.
All right.
You hate it.
I hate it.
Yeah.
And the term is this. It's VUCA. So that stands for... It's an acronym, because, of course, it's an acronym.
It has to be.
I've heard we use those in the Department of Defense.
And it's an initialism, I should say, right? But it stands for volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous.
Yeah.
And so the idea behind this acronym, and I think it came to be in the 1990s, was that somehow this time in the 90s, right, the post-Cold War period and transformation and all sorts of whiz-bang stuff happening, was somehow different from everything that had come before. And it required, therefore, like new ways of thinking and new ways of being and new ways of doing things. Okay, so fast forward, and we're still... We still use it.
Right.
Right. But what does it mean? How does it happen? And what does it tell us about our own time and maybe egocentrism that we are convinced that we're living in the most VUCA time ever?
It's all VUCA'd up, as it were. I don't know if we say that on a podcast. I guess we'll see.
Okay. But. So... All right, so what would it mean for something to be all VUCA'd up or all VUCA'd up, depending on how you want to say it?
Yeah, I tried to start something called APOP, which is the acronym phase out program, but nobody got the irony and we just kind of dropped it. So
DOA.
Yeah, it's DOA. That's right. DOA by COB. Yeah, I don't know why we still have VUCA, for example. So,
well, you know what's intensely ironic to me about VUCA is that it gains currency. And I may be wrong on this, and I'm sure if I am, I'll get like 15 commenters. It's the one thing about the internet.
Comment. Oh, yeah.
The internet will tell me that I'm wrong. So,
yeah.
But I may
Even
be wrong, but I believe
wrong,
that this became really current at the War College. As you said, it's in that period between the collapse of the Soviet Union and 9/11,
that's right.
Which, if we're being objective about like American power and security, that seems like a pretty happy time, right? I mean, you know, we're not dealing now with the constant threat of, you know, potentially a global thermonuclear war games
right.
reference, but we also aren't yet in that kind of unsatisfying, disturbing post 9/11 world. Also, there's no Snapchat, Facebook, the internet hasn't really become a thing.
Right.
Young people still make eye contact. I have this New Yorker cartoon on my door that says, when I make eye contact for the first time, I want it to be with the right person. So I don't really,
kids,
on some level,
days.
I don't even get how they could have thought that world was especially exceptional.
It is exceptional in the sense, if you think about uncertainty, I think the
budget
Cold
uncertainty.
War, there's budget uncertainty.
Yeah.
The Cold War, and it's sort of a perverse way to think about it, but political scientists like to talk all the time about how stable bipolar systems are, right? And that that unipolarity and multipolarity are actually far more unstable international systems. So I can see where all of these adjectives feel like they're happening in the 1990s
right.
in this period of sort of wandering or uncertainty. So it maybe it's only with hindsight that this sounds absurd.
I guess also, I mean, if you think of the 1990s, obviously before 9/11, for the U.S. military, there were all these, as you were saying, Andrew, unsatisfying interventions that were humanitarian interventions, right? So there was Somalia, there was the failed kind of intervention in Haiti initially, then there was a successful one, Then there was Rwanda, and that was really, we didn't intervene in that one. Then we had the Balkans and Kosovo. And so the military, they were wondering, with another acronym, right? Remember MOOTWA? M-O-O-T-W, Military Operations Other Than War. And so they're thinking, well, what is this military for if we can't use it? The Madeleine Albright quote. And then the whole question became about, well, so what is war? And they kind of made this meta argument, well, war is military operations other than MOOTWA. So it kind of folded in on itself until 9/11, and it seemed like, oh, wait, we got a purpose now, and we're going on the offense against
terrorists.
But then,
of course, that brings up other questions about the nature of war, about what war is, how long wars should last.
Right. And if you remember during the 2000 presidential campaign, I think it was Condoleezza Rice who said, look, the 82nd Airborne is not going to be escorting school children to school. It's we are not armed social workers. So there became all of that entwined in this kind of VUCA. Right? It's uncertain, it's complex, and it's ambiguous. Volatile, interestingly enough, didn't necessarily mean violent. It just meant all the other words, right? I mean, uncertain and ambiguous. Andrew, you and I were talking about that earlier. It's like, well, what's the difference between
volatile, uncertain, and ambiguous?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, well,
complex captures a different dynamic, but the other three... Mm.
Do they feel like synonyms?
So I guess, I mean, I definitely take your point that if you're looking at the world from the perspective of the U.S. Army, things do appear to be a bit weirder in 1992 than they did, say, in 1988.
Not less scary, but weirder.
Right, yeah. Right? So you don't have that pacing kind of power or scenario. It's like, we're not, okay, now it's not the fold the gap and all that other stuff. It's something else, and we're looking for that something else.
Right.
But from the perspective of world history, right, if any of us are looking for a period that we would sort of opt out of, I don't think the 1990s would be high on our list.
The 90s, right? I mean, I was like a kid. It was great.
Yeah. I wouldn't choose the 1990s.
All right, so this is a new way to frame the question, right? So if you could opt out, like just hands down, that is absolutely not the time or the place I would want to live. If we agree that the 1990s are okay, like scrunchies excluded.
Yeah, and obviously there's a where here, right? So we're talking America in the 1990s, right? Because your point, Rwanda as a Tutsi in the 1990s is not great.
No. No, it reminds me of one of my old professors from the University of Denver who used to pick, he was a historian, he would pick battles he would want to be in because, those are the ones that particular side wants. So, you know, Battle of Hastings, English side. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, this will be a winner for me. I want to be there and say, awesome. I was at that one and I won. So, yeah, but which one do you not want to be on?
Battle of Cannae on the Roman side. that's like 70,000. But I mean, I think there are a lot of good candidates for opting out. But I think I would opt out of like Western Europe in the 14th century. So in the 1300s.
Yeah.
You know, the plague, it takes anywhere from like a third to a half. I guess if you count all of the sort of iterations of epidemics from like 1349.
And it just keeps coming back.
Yeah, through the end of the century. It's like half the population. And then on top of that, as Jackie and I teach this great books course, we read Barbara Tuchman's book, A Distant Mirror, which is a really wonderful book to read, even if, you know, as a medieval historian, I'm sure they will quibble with some of her analysis and conclusions. But one thing
that... I have to put that disclaimer in right now, that as a historian... We don't read that book for history reasons.
It's beautifully written, though, and a great book. I highly recommend it. And on the big facts, I think she's pretty accurate that it was an awful time. You know, just an awful time, and there's war all over the place. And at that time, the Catholic Church also goes through a terrible crisis, which really shakes, I think, people's confidence in sort of the one institution that was going to give them
binding, right?
Like a feeling of maybe safety despite all this horrible stuff that's going on. It's like, well, at least I've got God. Well,
now there's popes
maybe
and anti-popes.
Not.
And,
right, and at least it was a binding kind of political institution in a way as well.
All right, so, okay, so Europe in the 14th century, Western Europe, not a place we want to live.
Not a great one.
Paul, what about you?
Oh, well, definitely in the late 1930s, China. when you're invaded by the Japanese.
That's a bad one.
Yeah, around Manchuria and the puppet regime of Manchukuo. And I just, you know, on the Chinese side, you don't want to be around that because it's just as terrifying as anything that was occurring.
Plus, that pretty much goes up through, like, the Great Leap Forward. And, I mean, you have, like, several decades of bad.
That's a good point.
If you're a Chinese
peasant. Yeah, I was going to say Great Leap Forward is not. And it's not that much longer
until the Cultural Revolution occurs in China. So you're going through that period. And then just as you're out of that, you begin the seedlings of Tiananmen Square. So, yeah, there's that sort of horrifying bookend of the Republic of China when the Republic of China is invaded to the People's Republic of China and the social experiments that go on there. So, yeah, I would want to opt out of that. And actually, on my dad's side, who's from Hong Kong, they opted out in the 60s because they were concerned that during the Proletariat Revolution and the Cultural Revolution that China was going to roll over the border into Hong Kong, take it from the British anyway. So they said, see ya, we're going to Canada. So, they were actually Canadians for, well, they still are Canadians.
All right, Jackie.
All right, so I'm going to go with North America in the sort of decades preceding the Columbian Exchange and to include sort of conquest by Western European explorers.
Being a Native American.
Being a Native American in that period. Just because I'm trying to imagine the terror of epidemic and disease that has come earlier.
Yeah, and actually for most of them it precedes the arrival of actual Europeans.
And so you have clearly something's happening, right? Up to 90% of the population is gone. Ugh. And you have no, right? You don't have a theory of germs. You don't have a theory of disease. So I think we're back to your point about sort of plague. You, when it's unpredictable and it's taking literally just everyone, and you have no explanation for what's happening. And then, of course, once the Europeans do arrive, things don't get any better.
Yeah,
that would be an understatement.
We see the consequences of it right here in Carlisle. There's constant reminders of what European colonization does to native populations. Talk about volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. To put yourself in the shoes of someone else, right, to have that sort of empathy for other people in other places, whether it's Rwandan in 1994 or a Chinese person.
During the 30s.
During the 30s.
And then on through into the People's Republic of China,
So I think that, to me, that's what, maybe more than anything else, that's what VUCA misses, is that any of your own experiences when you're trying to make sense of the wider world around you are going to probably feel volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And to treat our own time period as if it's somehow exceptional feels intellectually and sort of morally wrong.
Yeah,
to me,
it's weird. I often wonder whether we need a new lexicon. Or do we already have the right words that we're just misapplying? We're sort of using them on the wrong problem. So VUCA being the example of, that acronym is almost a word, the way we kind of treat it around here. So it is kind of a lexicon in a way.
Well, it becomes shorthand, right?
That's right.
It's means intellectual shorthand. Sorts of things, brings up all sorts of connotations or whatever. But do we think it's useful?
I don't think it's useful because I don't think it creates any kind of like distinguishing framework where you would sort of say, hey, this period demands these special tools. Like, find me a time in history when, you know, good judgment and like a sort of rigorous, open-minded approach to understanding your environment weren't useful.
Or where a stewardship of resources wasn't required.
Yeah, or wise.
Or strategic.
Yeah, or just wise in general.
Or strategic vision and thinking wasn't.
Yeah, I think to your point, human beings, we are very egocentric. I mean, each human being is sort of his or her own universe. And for that reason, I mean, and there's a lot of good in that. Like, I think in Western civilization, we certainly celebrate the individual and the meaning of the individual. But one of the consequences is, I think, of that individualism is you tend to see the period you inhabit as exceptional because you're in it. Like, you are the star
right.
of the show, and you're in it. One of our colleagues, Buck Haberichter, has this hilarious sign in his office that says, like, if my life is a movie, it has a great cast, but the plot is confusing, you know? So, and yeah, sometimes the plot is confusing because it's challenging, but I feel like we really ought to push back a little bit on this tendency, because to your point about VUCA, yeah, it starts in the early 90s, but interestingly, it hasn't gone away.
We still use it.
We still use it. And you're seeing different words. Paul, you talked about language and how we're using these terms, but you're seeing different words used to describe this. Like, there was a recent, relatively recent piece by General John Allen, retired Marine General John Allen, who obviously is very highly regarded, really, I'm sure, a bright guy. He wrote this piece with Amir Hussein on hyperwar.
Yeah.
Okay. And he talks about what hyperwar consists of, and you know, it's he talks about AI and automation and so on. He says the major effect result of all these capabilities coming together will be an innovation warfare has never seen before. The minimization of human decision making and the vast majority of processes traditionally required to wage war. So that, I think, is a meaningful change. But then it sort of talks about how that affects the speed
right.
with which war proceeds. And yes. you know, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Because then again, we still get into the operational description of war, right? The speed, whether human beings will be in the loop. But what could be a strategic cause or reason for war around AI? It might be something that becomes ideological about AI. It's like, well, why does this mm-hmm. country have this advantage, which is AI, and we don't? And what does that mean for their national power? So it's actually a bigger question than just hey,
right.
the
it
speed
could actually
of
break down lots of questions about the composition of power. How do you constitute power? How do you execute it? What are the limits of
right.
various forms of power and things like that? We've talked about speed of change. Mm. A couple of times, right? And I think that's one of the things that actually maybe VUCA misses. Maybe that's sort of encapsulated in volatile.
Well, interestingly, it's not, right? So here's the thing about volatility. This is the dorky statistician coming out. So volatility, you can have a highly volatile situation in which change isn't occurring right. at a high rate. Volatility is just dispersion around the mean of change. Whereas, like, If you have like Moore's law says, hey, you know, the number of circuits on an integrated circuit doubles every whatever, 18
years.
Months or, you know, depending on the formulation. Well, if that's a reliable relationship, that's not volatile. But that's really rapid change. Mm-hmm. And we have seen huge changes, obviously, right. in technology. But there's sort of some consistency in those changes.
Yeah. It's like every time you go to the Apple store and buy a new iPhone, you might as well just have a garbage can at the end of the counter because the next one's rolling out. It's like, all right, let me just throw that one away and grab this.
By the time you get to the
checkout. Yeah, oh, there's a new iOS, yeah.
So is there something about speed that we have to account for when we're thinking about change and warfare in particular, or the information environment or whatever it is? So are there things that are qualitatively different about the 21st century than, say, about the 13th century or the 19th century?
Well, the short answer is, I mean, yes, things are really different. As Homer Simpson once said, the internet is on the computer now.
It's on the computer, right?
So, yeah. So things are different. But, I mean, I don't know. Like, I guess I would say that the speed thing could be really dangerous. I'm reminded of my old friend Schlieffen, right? So, like, you know, Schlieffen hit the Prussian.
You were buddies with him?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I'm a little older than I look. So
you look great.
Yeah,
I need to get on your vitamin program.
The Prussian war planner, right? So, author of the Schlieffen plan. But like, one of the problems with that was like all of the assumptions about speed, right? That drove sort of this need to then, you know, go to war quickly in the event that you thought war might be emerging.
Right, because you think you're not going to have time to respond, because you think the first blow is going to be the only blow. I more meant in terms of the speed of maybe the dispersion or adoption of new technologies, responses to it.
Okay, so I'm kind of getting there, right? So speed, technological speed is a factor of processing power and communication primarily, with like storage kind of playing an important role, but less of a role all the time, interestingly. And so that's really what's behind this kind of acceleration broadly. But in this argument about the speed of war itself, it's the same factors that are they argue are driving this. And so yes, that is different, but I think it's dangerous for us to accept that because of that, we must become much more quick sort of to respond as a nation to these sort of arising national security challenges. I think there's great virtue in coming up with ways to slow things down, develop resilience, right? Like,
or maybe the response to speed, to the increasing speed of something is actually to, like you said, to slow it down.
Right.
To create an obstacle, speed bump, rather than to match the speed.
Well, time can be asymmetric, can be an asymmetric advantage or disadvantage in warfare. I mean, that's what we've been seeing with our current wars, Afghanistan and
we always assume
Iraq,
that time is bad for us. Like, that the more time passes, the worse it is for us. That's what we seem to assume.
Right.
Well, I think that has mostly borne out
in these wars that Paul was describing, which makes sense, right? Because we're the away team. There's huge asymmetry of interests there.
And of course, you know, Jackie being a historian can validate or invalidate this, where the quote-unquote American way of war was attritional warfare for the longest time, was we're going to throw a lot of men and material at this problem and just grind it out.
Well, this is true maybe in the American Civil War and World War II, which are not
actually... And the Revolutionary War.
No, that's not the...
No, but time. I'm talking about the time element.
Yeah, but not attritional way. So, yes,
I was thinking about time.
Two different
anyway,
points
go ahead.
That a historian must validate. But World War II and the American Civil War are not typical of American experiences,
wars.
Right? So we think about what American militaries have been actually doing, and it's much more in line with nation building, armed social workers,
smaller wars.
That's actually the American, I think there's a pretty compelling case we made, that's actually the American way of war. Now we see constant pushback. We don't like it.
Right.
We think that maybe is not what it should be. Even right now you can see in like PME curricula, COIN is moving out.
Right.
And we're going to start talking about near-peer competitors
and major
war again. Because I think this is what the American standing army is.
Well, and there's no appetite in the U.S. military for accepting risk early in a conflict. I mean, the interesting thing is that we tend to, it seems like historically we've done better as a nation in the conflicts that we sort of started out not doing particularly well.
Yeah, so I mean, there's
so I guess what I wanted to ask you, Jackie, is, and I totally take your point about how, you know, the time not being on our side has been borne out, but if you consider, say, like a Russian adventure in the Baltics or a Chinese quote unquote adventure in Taiwan, if we had a way of protracting that, right? Like making that less decisive for them, then time, I think, is on the side of the United States,
it's
right?
I would say it's rarely on the side of the more powerful actor, because I think power often sort of degrades over time. And will degrades. And I think, I mean, for democracies, I think it's even more complicated.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe it's, I think it's maybe just differently complicated than it is for autocracies, which, coming back to our point, which is everything's complicated. and there's not very, you know, easy answers on this stuff.
No, not at all. And that's, again, that's why I'm sort of wondering whether or not we do we have the right vocabulary, or do we need a,
right, so
a
what
new
would
one?
What would be a more useful, if VUCA is not useful, if it's sort of egocentric and not descriptive and the categories aren't very helpful, what would be more useful ways of thinking about...
Well, I guess the question is, are you trying to describe your period in comparison to other periods, or are you trying to just help people be better at understanding the period that they inhabit, whatever it is? Because if the second is what you're going for, that you're just trying to equip people with better tools for analyzing their own time, then whatever. I mean, these are all kind of interesting and useful ideas. I kind of take issue with the implied, like, exceptionalism, you know, that we've used, in which we've used VUCA here at the War College.
And it's VUCA is not even necessarily about time. It's because it's always applied to the environment. It's a VUCA environment, the strategic environment. So, okay, that has no time limit. It's not necessarily bounded by time. It's the operating strategic
environment.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
which I think is that's a word that I would advocate for, or adaptation, or something like that.
Yeah.
Evolution or adaptation.
But yeah, so the environment itself is VUCA, and that's where.
But
I've
if all environments are VUCA, is
that's right.
Who cares?
Why is it useful? That's my point. So despite the age.
Yeah.
Despite what, you know.
So one, I think one thing that we really, I think one thing that in my experience here at the War College, I've noticed amongst many students is a tendency to fail to acknowledge the degree to which whatever the thing is that we're trying to do militarily, it's probably just the start. Even in the most successful scenario, it's just the start of some kind of multi-decade commitment that involves other elements of American power and unofficial kind of American power. Mm. And that, you know, end state is not a useful kind of construct. Like your work, Paul, on narco trafficking and drug cartels and stuff like that. I often think of the drug wars as a great kind of microcosm, even though that's its own macro thing. It's a microcosm of this problem. Like, drug war, I think, is a terrible metaphor.
Oh, it is.
Right? Because wars can be won.
Yeah, and drugs can't fight back.
Well, there's a great book by Fred Eakley called Every War Must End right? Which, if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. It's a short reading, read in the afternoon. But the premise is, in fact, that all wars come to an end. He's trying to interrogate how and why.
Right.
And I think... in my mind, what we see and what we have seen historically in some cases, but not wanted to admit, is that some wars may not end, or some wars, right, sort of plant. This is back to Liddell Hart, and they plant the seeds of the next one, and it's far less bounded by time and definitive start and endpoints. One of my favorite things to do to ask students. When we're talking about a historical war, say, let's say World War One. When did World War One start?
Depends.
Be as specific as you can.
Yeah.
Right? When does it start? Does it start with mobilization? Does it start with a declaration of war? Does it start with the first shots fired? Yeah. Does it start for different countries on different days? And it's that question
starts with the Franco-Prussian War.
Yeah, does it start centuries before?
Yeah.
And that question is just as complicated as when does World War One end, right? Mm. Like, I think they just paid off the last sort of World War One reparations and war debts like 2 years ago.
Well, and there is that whole long war, like Neil Ferguson and others, you know, describing the 20th century as just like one long war that starts in whatever, 1914, we'll call it, and ends in 1991.
Yeah, but that becomes kind of politically problematic as
well. And I mean,
you can't sort of, that, if you're a politician.
You can, and it, let's elevate that another maker, level. Now it becomes like all of human history, right? It's like one long war.
Well, you can't, you know, you can't be a president and say,
into,
hey,
like,
let me start a war.
Quotes, right? About, what is it? The armistice, or peace is only
the treacherous
armistice is not endless war, which is not actually Thucydides, but Wonder Woman said it was Thucydides, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Must be true.
Did Wonder Woman was quoting Thucydides?
No, Wonder Woman said she
was misquoting Thucydides,
but it was not.
Who is she actually quoting? You know,
it's unclear.
Was it Sun Tzu?
Probably.
You don't know. We don't know.
So I think there's all of this suggests there are lots more complicated ways we need to be talking about war and strategy and the strategic environment and the strategic problem. In trying to come up with, again, that more useful language and that more useful vocabulary.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we don't have time to offer our students a course on philosophy or semiotics or things like that.
That's
which
sort
would
of
be awesome.
That's sort of how I teach the theory of war and strategy. I'm sure my students love it.
Well,
I tell them on the first day, this is a philosophy class.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing here.
Mm, it's big thoughts. Yeah.
Yeah, so I also tell them they can't use a VUCA. So maybe they go together. I'm still ready to ban it.
Ban it. I just want
Orwellian. I'm not going to ban words from my classroom.
Yeah. I know my students over time, they haven't really, there'll be one or two students who'll use it. And then it sort of drops.
Does it just feel buzzwordy? Like it feels like a thing that they're supposed to say?
Yeah, they do it. And then, of course, there's no real solution for it. It's like, okay, well, how do you make the environment less VUCA? How do you, or just pick one. How do you make it less uncertain or less complex? It's like, well, you know. And so they also get into the kind of very binary thinking of, well, it's either VUCA or it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, no.
There's a spectrum of VUCA?
Even if you accept VUCA as the whole ball of wax, the whole gamut. There are a lot of other things that are not necessarily un-VUCA'd, you know, where there's a kind of normal point. It's like, okay, here's normal and here's VUCA. It's like, well, I don't know when that would ever have been. It's like, well, right. What was that period?
Yeah,
of time
imagine a hearing where like some service chief sits down in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee and says, well, sirs and madams,
we're good.
We like the way the world is right now.
We're good.
Well, it's almost.
We pretty much. We have more.
Yeah, we're gonna.
We have more than we need. We're gonna cancel.
We're gonna. We're gonna hold here. You know.
So that's not. I mean, that's not good for for the sort of self-looking ice cream cone or whatever you want to call it. That you have to convince someone else, your political masters, the people with the purse strings. You've got to create. Need.
Oh yeah, there's right? a definite incentive to inflate
need,
inflate risk,
inflate threat, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, if you go back again, you brought up the example of quote unquote the war on drugs or the drug war, and metrics. So one of the metrics you could use to say you're winning or you're losing the drug war would be number of interdictions of drug loads. So we'll say it's interdiction of cocaine coming across the border.
I can see why this is a problem.
You know, this year we have caught the biggest loads of cocaine ever. So we are clearly, what, winning or losing the war on drugs?
Right.
How much cocaine is coming in?
It could be,
is more better?
Yeah, because we're catching more, therefore we're winning, so give us more money and we'll end this. Or, man, they are sending a whole lot more drugs that we're not catching, and they feel brazen enough to send this much. We need more money to tackle this in bigger ways. Yeah, because they're clearly brazen. So
the argument can go either way, and it's
that's right.
Sort of unmoored from evidence.
Yeah,
that's my favorite kind of argument.
You do well in Washington.
I don't know about that.
Well, there's that organization. I wish I could remember the name of it. I think they're in Sweden. They track international violent deaths year on year.
They've got that CIPRI.
I think it's CIPRI.
I mean, there's a couple of
different databases. Yeah. They do, and they have like one of the best databases on violent deaths in conflict, both civil wars and interstate wars and other types. And you know what's telling when you look at that is, and these are deaths like as a sort of proportion of the population.
Right.
So it'd be like your actuarial risk of dying in a violent conflict that they've declined pretty much consistently since the end of the Second World War. I think 2014 was notable because it was like the first year-on-year increase in a long time. Syria
was a big,
and some other things were causing that. So, you know, broadly speaking, and this is as a guy who works at the Army War College, so I'm like, I don't want to talk down the portfolio, but I mean, the world is broadly speaking a relatively safe place. You know, and so that's not to say
and
that
for Americans, it's a particularly
right
safe place,
right? And so. I believe absolutely in preparing ourselves for a world in which right. other bad things might happen and so on and so forth. But I kind of think we don't help ourselves when we're not describing the world as it is.
Yeah, or threat inflation, mm-hmm. which we've right. heard. That's a term, you know, a term of art, threat inflation.
All right, so final verdict, VUCA. VUCA. Up, thumbs down.
You know, funny, I'm not necessarily for banning it. I would keep it just as an intellectual foil to actually, if we're going to start this conversation, and I don't know, to just kind of tear it down. 'Cause always like a good opportunity to poke holes in something. Sure. So this seems to be a good one for now. And
yeah. I think we need some clarity about why we're using the term. Like, what are we trying to accomplish? I think it's totally bogus mm. as a sort of comparative tool. I mean,
Oh, that's a good point.
You would be
yeah.
hard-pressed to demonstrate, okay, that our period is more VUCA'd up, to use Paul's term, than other periods, right?
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, I think it's demonstrably...
Like the 1930s. You mentioned the 1930s yeah. in China, but like...
The
you
1930s
know, what about
Europe.
Like, yeah, the 1930s. Yeah.
1930s in... South America.
Yeah.
These are all...
Or being an Iraqi from 1980 right. through to today.
Or
yeah.
From
I mean, my God.
1919.
Oh,
yeah.
Through
yeah.
today. I mean, yeah. These yeah. are.
So as a comparative tool, I think it's indefensible. As an analytical tool, I don't think we teach it that way. Like, I don't think we don't use it as a tool for actually. Hmm. analyzing the environment.
Right. I think it's just shorthand.
It's just a shorthand for saying, oh, the world is...
complicated
is,
or complex.
Woo, like, yeah. there's a lot going on out there.
That's busy.
Like,
oh, boy.
Like, if we did a heat map of, like, headaches yeah. or something, you know, potential
right.
national security headaches, somehow the yeah. implication is that, like, the world is just super hot, right?
Yeah.
Well, I kind of think the world's always that way. I would rather have a conversation, you know, where we talked about things in a way that really facilitated like analysis yeah. where you could maybe help people understand, hey, where are things going and what are our reasonable expectations about that? Like that might help us in Afghanistan,
yeah.
for example.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
what is the kind of war termination condition for the United
and
States?
And what are the possible
in
futures
Afghanistan?
We
right.
can imagine?
Yeah.
What are the war termination? Yeah. This is sort of where I am. I find it. I'm probably closer to banning it than either of you, because I find it both comparatively problematic.
Have you not listened to your Sezivuka?
And analytically not terribly yeah. useful. So I think it's good to sort of break down and poke holes in things, but I'd rather sort of build something up and constitute something.
Oh yeah, that's a fair point.
More
yeah.
useful. So anyway, gentlemen, thanks for joining me today here on A Better Peace, the War Room podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Jackie.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.